Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining editor Simon Lambert and me today is knowledge and product editor Sarah Davidson. And coming up, autumn is here, and with it, an ill wind through the savings market. But why are things looking so bleak, and are there any warm spots out there to be found? There's a veritable hurricane happening in politics. We'll offer some tips on how to weather the Brexit storm. Should we really be stockpiling food? And we'll also take a look at how Labour's right to buy plans would work in practice. Plus, just how much better for the environment are electric vehicles? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, 12 months ago, Marcus burst onto the scene to give a rare and much-needed boost for savers. A mini-rates war followed, with even a high street bank, RBS NatWest, getting in on the action with its own 1.5% deal. Fast forward, though, to now, and good old Marcus has trimmed its offering. NS&I, Virgin, Nationwide also been slashing their rates this summer. So is that it? Is 1.5% as good as we can expect before recession worries and rate cuts set in? Firstly, Simon, you're back from your holidays. You've had a marvellous summer. Not so good for savers. What's been going on?
No, all good things must come to an end, as they say. Mm. Whether you can include a 1.5% savings rate in under the banner of all good things, I'm not so sure. It's not like quite like a beautiful romance or a wonderful holiday or a period of time before anybody knew about the word Brexit.
we can dream.
But just under a year ago, Marcus, the online consumer savings bank of Goldman Sachs, burst onto the scene mm-hmm. with a heady 1.5% rate, which eclipsed all others, which our very own Lee Boyce had said a month earlier it was going to do. He'd tipped people off that this was the thinking, this was going to happen, and it arrived and it didn't disappoint. And as you said, some other banks up their game, mm-hmm. And we had that 1.5% rate, but sadly, this week, it was cut. It's down to 1.45%. Now, a 0.05% difference on your savings is not going to make a material difference to many people. You would need to have an awful lot of money before you really felt the pinch from that. And then you would have so much money that you would probably not feel the pinch from that. But as you said, there is a bit of an ill wind blowing for savers. It's not been a great summer. Rates have been being cut. Nationwide, which never let us forget is on your side, has been busy spending the summer cutting savings rates, blaming the fact that the mortgage market is so competitive and it's having to keep rates low. Banks and building societies all over the place are doing the same thing because they're trying to protect their margins. And there's a couple of things going on here. One, we have this super competitive mortgage market, which is driven by two things. One, banks and building societies have lots of money they'd like to lend out to people, and not so many people who want to borrow all of it. So there is a bit of a fierce rate war going on. And also you have HSBC, global mega bank, that due to ring fencing rules has a big pot of cash that it's trying to do something with and is trying to grow its market share in the UK mortgage market. Not hugely, but by enough that other banks and building societies are pointing the finger at it and saying it's dragging down the rates. Now, those two things are in conjunction. But then also the other side of this pincer movement is that interest rates are falling. The Fed in America has cut rates. Interest rate expectations are now that they will go down rather than up. The cost of government borrowing, UK gilts, has dived from about 0.75% to 0.4% on the two-year measure this year. Swap rates, which are money market rates that affect mortgage and saving pricing, they have also fallen. And so then this week we also had NS&I, the nation's savings bank, cutting a number of its products, which is a real disappointment for savers. But ultimately, it has to balance its rates and helping savers with also the need to not be too competitive in the market because it's not allowed to grab all the business from everyone else, and the fact that it's a way of the government raising money. And to put it bluntly, the government can raise money a hell of a lot cheaper elsewhere than paying savers a decent rate at the moment.
So putting NS&I, I suppose, to one side, it's a bit more unique. It's not our fault, Gov. Is that fair?
as in providers are...
It's HSBC's fault. It's the mortgage market's fault. Yeah. It's everybody else apart from us.
I think so. I mean, ultimately, banks and building societies are businesses and they need to make money in order to survive. And as Simon's already said, the profit margins are so narrow because of all of these different things putting pressure on them that they're really, they are between a rock and a hard place, I think. You could argue, though, that the most fierce competition in the mortgage market, which is keeping savings rates low, is for super prime borrowers with loads of money in their property. So they've got 50% deposit, 50% equity, good credit rating. And that those are the people who will get the absolute cheapest mortgage rates. There's an argument to say you can price mortgages a bit more highly for people who've got less money to put into their property, who might have a poorer credit rating or might have recently gone self-employed and therefore not have a huge kind of financial history or 3 years accounts going back historically, and that mortgage lenders could price those mortgages a bit higher. They're still not going to be hugely expensive, and that off the back of that, that would allow them to raise savings rates in some places. And indeed, actually, that's why you see the best buy rates from these kind of smaller specialist challenger banks, because that's what they're doing. They are lending out not to prime homeowners, but to these kind of more specialist borrowers.
So Simon, with all the talk about, and I'll ask you, how likely do you think a recession is? Get your crystal ball out. Interest rate cuts here. You've posed the question, is will 1.5% be as good as it gets for savers? Is that what you think?
I think it might be.
Yeah, your face says it all.
I think it might be.
Unless,
so, I mean, you've got to bear in mind that there is two factors at play with that Marcus savings rate. One, at the time, rate expectations were that they would go up, that things would improve for savers. We didn't have the same downward rate expectations going on. So you were in a very gently rising market, but you were in a market that was on the rise rather than the fall. And two, we're talking about Goldman Sachs here. You're banking with the vampire squid. It's got a lot of money, okay? And when it decides that it wants to make a dent in the UK savings market and scoop up a load of customers, bear in mind, I believe they did 50,000 in a fortnight, 100,000 in a month, you know? That's the stuff of dreams for banks and building society chief executives who, let us remember, would both like to reward their customers and swell their pay packets, and you can make your own decision as to which one they're most concerned about. But, you know, when you want to make that kind of dent in the market and you've got the kind of money behind you that Goldman Sachs has, you can afford to go out and pay UK savers 1.5%. You can afford to go out and eclipse all the other accounts on the market. You can afford to go out and scoop up 50,000, 100,000 customers, more than that as things continued, because you have deep pockets. You can bung in a loss leader. And I have an element of sympathy with the banks and the building societies, but I have only a limited element of sympathy because, after all, they are all players in the market. You can't just go around blaming the market that you are actually a member of. They could decide to price mortgages higher and give people higher savings rates. The reason why they say they can't do it is because, well, we could do it, but then unless everybody else does it, we'll lose out. I mean, it's the classic argument for everything, isn't it? We could do the right thing, but we can't do the right thing because the other people aren't doing the right thing. I don't know. I mean, maybe you should look at Britain's building society industry and ask whether maybe perhaps that should be doing the right thing. But we have a selection of very large building societies that, frankly, are run pretty much like banks, and where the executives are paid like bankers. And also we have this eternal quest for growth. They want to grow their numbers. So they can't rein in the mortgage lending. They have to be seen to be pressing the button mark, lend some more people some money and expanding their balance sheets, because they need to try and justify the growth. And also, you've got to remember as well that, yeah, they lend out money on mortgages, but a lot of these guys lend out money in other ways as well. Personal loan rates, also very low, but only if you're in the 51% of people who actually get accepted for the personal loan at that headline rate. The other people end up paying a lot more. Credit card rates. I mean, they're knocking around the sort of 19% mark as standard. That's quite a lot more than 1.5% on your savings. Overdraft rates. Now, banks and building societies have been told to stop ripping people off with overdrafts, either with sort of unauthorised overdraft charges, which they're basically lending people money that they shouldn't be able to borrow, and also with these sort of 50p or a pound a day things. And so they've responded to this by, well, one of the first to respond to this was Nationwide, by whacking up its overdraft charges for everyone. So only a small number of its customers were paying, or a relatively small chunk, were paying these kind of 50p a day charges. But in order to get rid of those, it's whacked up the cost for everyone. So I have a limited amount of sympathy for them when they start telling us that they have no choice but to cut our savings rates. If you were to read the comments on our articles, you will find out that many of our readers, and I suspect many of the people listening to this podcast, will have a limited amount of sympathy for the argument that is put forward. Unfortunately, to go back to your question that you asked me, I think that argument's just going to get stronger and stronger and stronger from these banks and building societies, and I think maybe 1.5% was as good as it got for now.
Well, it all sounds rather bleak, and I am conscious that I'm about to talk about politics, so I want to slightly lighten the mood before we get into that. Is there a way we can lighten the mood here? Is there any positivity to be taken?
Well, I think, life goes on. While politicians argue and throw curveballs left, right and centre, I think, normal everyday life continues to happen. Actually, if you look at the figures, wage growth is pretty good at the moment. It's outstripping inflation, which is good. So we all have a little bit more money in our pockets. Consumer credit lending, as Simon referred to earlier, credit cards, borrowing on credit cards and personal loans, is also pretty high. Spending is not suffering just yet in terms of consumer spending, although business investment is definitely down because of a lot of the political uncertainty. So I think it doesn't look too bleak on that basis. It's the not knowing that's putting pressure on everything, rather than the fundamentals of the market being broken, I think. So if we can get some sort of resolution at a political level, whatever that resolution is, it will allow people to start moving forward.
That's general positivity. And thank you.
I tried.
Yeah, well done. Well done with our personal finances. But more specifically in the savings market, is there anything, or is it time to turn to investing? Is that also a bit bleak at the moment? I mean, or is it just the element of, look, saving is more important than the rate you're going to get on it?
Well, first, saving is important. If you don't have any savings, then having some money saved for a rainy day, or then building up a pot over and above that, actually, when you're at that point, then the rate that you're getting on your savings is not actually that important. It's very nice to be rewarded for saving, and trust me, if interest rates are higher, you get rewarded better for it. But it's more the actual act of saving and having a pot of money that's important at the time. Then once you move beyond the fact that you've got, that 3 months' worth of wages stashed away in case you lose your job, the rainy day pot for when the boiler breaks or the clutch goes on the car, then that's great. And then, you can think about investing your money. And there are lots of places where you can invest your money and get a much higher return. I have done two investment shows over the last month or so where I've spoken to two different investment trust managers who both have income investment trusts that invest in very, very different things. One of them was a guy called Mike Curley, who runs a trust called Henderson Far East Income, and that invests in companies in Asia for dividends, and it yields about 5.5%, and it's been yielding the 5-6% mark pretty much every year for as long as I can remember, and it's up over a period of time. Now, obviously, if you invest your money, the share price could go down in value, but it's delivering a pretty steady income, and unless you actually need that money back at that given point in time, you can wait for the share price to go back up. A completely different investment, a guy who runs something called JLEN Environmental Assets Group, that invests into renewable energy projects. Again, that yields 5.6%. That's been yielding a pretty steady more than 5% for quite some time. So there are opportunities out there that don't just involve going and trying investing your money into UK equity, where a lot of people go and buy UK shares to try and earn their income. But you do have to take the risk that, you know, the money that you invest, it could go down in value. But I think that, as Sarah said, actually, the problem is at the moment is that banks and building societies are at the point in the sort of economic cycle where they would expect lots of people to be wanting to borrow money on mortgages. And because mortgages are so big, that's why it influences the market so much. But people aren't. And some of that's to do with the fact that homes never really got cheap after the financial crisis. Some of that's to do, so there's a problem raising a deposit and meeting the affordability and things like that. But a lot of that's just to do with the general sense of kind of uncertainty and the B word and all that other stuff. And maybe if it wasn't for that, you'd have more people wanting to borrow money. And then you'd have these banks and building societies more actively wanting to get savers' money on board so that they can then push the button on the computer that lends somebody some money and expands their balance sheet because they need to have some stuff at either end. And then maybe you would see savings rates rising. But at the moment, that element of competing because they want to do that has been had the legs chopped off from underneath it.
Indeed it has. We're talking about the B word, not borrowing, Brexit. I would say not Boris, but actually Boris was also involved in all of this. But I promise you we'll keep it brief politics, shall we? Because it would be...
the three Bs.
The brief, Boris,
Boris
and
Brexit and brief.
You've got your own views on that. Yes, it would be rather remiss of us not to to touch on what's been going on in Westminster at the moment and look at how it can impact our finances. However, positively, and a sterling job you did there, Sarah, in trying to be positive about it, and I'm sure there's no reason not to be, but ever since Boris Johnson declared Brexit was do or die on the 31st of October, the odds of a no deal were slashed. All of the political shenanigans of late mean they just keep dropping. But beyond these leaked reports, Sarah, food shortages, the increased cost of living, you've been looking at what a no deal, well, this is money, you've been looking at what a no deal would mean for our personal finances. You've been asking the experts for their advice on how to protect your wealth. So savings seems a rather good place to start, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. While we've just had a long conversation about how rates have been cut, there are still easy access rates out there at 1.5%. Synergy Bank is still offering that at the moment. We spoke to a couple of saving experts and they suggested that because we don't really know what's going to happen with interest rates at the Bank of England level, it's probably not a great plan to tie your money into a longer term fixed rate bond at the moment, because if you, for example, you tie your money up for 3 years, a lot can happen in 3 years, and one would hope we'll be past this before then. It's likely that we will see interest rates go up eventually. So you might not want to tie your money into rock bottom rates at the moment. So actually looking at easy access rates is a good thing to do. Also, 1 year fixed rates offer some fairly decent returns. You know, it's all relative.
Yeah.
But there are not bad products out there. So I think kind of a mix of those shorter term products is a good plan when there is uncertainty, because it gives you that flexibility. Mm-hmm. In terms of preparing in other ways, if we do go into recession or we see an economic kind of bump as a result of either Brexit or no Brexit, there are lots of things you can do, and it's just basic financial planning, actually. And it would be true whether or not Brexit was on the horizon. But things like, you know, if you're coming to the end of your mortgage term, don't leave it to the last minute. Talk to a mortgage broker, see if you can remortgage onto a good deal. Because while mortgage rates are insanely low at the moment, actually, if you get to the end of your 2 year term, your 5 year term, and you flip onto the standard variable rate, you will see your mortgage payments go up considerably. So it's a really good idea to just have that conversation early. Some lenders will let you remortgage up to three months before the end of your term as well. So there are great deals out there. Bad news for savers is actually good news for mortgage borrowers and homeowners.
So, pensions, have we got any news on that?
Yes, there has been a bit of news, which is that I think it's that their payments, expats living in Europe, will still receive their pension post Brexit, and they will still be uprated for 3 years. Beyond that, we still don't know, but that's a little bit of positive news in what frankly was quite a worrying situation for a lot of people who live on the continent. So,
all right, so it's the same advice, isn't it? Just good financial planning, whatever may
be prepared
come our way. Yes, exactly. But one thing I do have to ask you, though, about is a lot has been spoken about fears over food shortages. And there's been a couple of articles on your website. Barclays reckon we're stockpiling food, particularly young people. I've been a little bit dubious about this, but clear it up for me, would you, Simon? Should we? Are we stockpiling food?
Well, let me say this. I am a firm believer in not stockpiling food.
Right.
I have always thought that stockpiling food is completely bananas, and there's been a number of times over the years when people have decided to stockpile their food. I think the classic example of stockpiling was during the petrol crisis, when there was all the queues outside the petrol stations. Fortunately, I was actually out the country at the time, so I couldn't even be tempted to stockpile food because I had no need to. However, I'd also kind of hoped that I would never be in the scenario where I looked at the country and thought, maybe I do need to stockpile some food. Mm. I mean, maybe we're there now. I mean, we do keep getting warnings about the food supply chain and everything like that under the threat of no-deal Brexit. And who knows whether the threat of no-deal Brexit has gone away or hasn't. I mean, it's a complete mystery to most people. Apparently, we can't have a no-deal Brexit now, but then we could still have a no-deal Brexit. So maybe you might want to chuck a couple of extra tins of Frey Bentos in the cupboard.
Nobody needs to do that. But look,
you can't stockpile fresh food because
exactly.
It won't be any good. I mean, two, yeah, maybe you could bung a few extra tins of stuff in the cupboard, buy a few extra packets of pasta, but
really?
Are we really going to run out of packets of spaghetti?
Really?
I mean, this is going to come back so hard on me come the 14th of November when I cannot buy a packet of spaghetti for love nor money. And I'm out there on the streets offering people my worldly possessions in return for some spaghetti. But I don't know. I'm not doing it. What I would say, though, and I don't want to go too far into this, but
yeah.
Brexit, you know, is a... And I do think we should leave because we voted to leave. I didn't vote to leave, but I do think we should leave because I don't think it's a good idea to have a vote and then not actually do it,
yeah.
Right? But it is a textbook example, I think, that will be looked at in years to come of absolutely bungling something that really didn't need to be bungled. Like, from one, calling the referendum in the first place with that question, to the campaign on both sides in the referendum that was just full of misinformation and not only full of misinformation but completely lacking any of the information or thinking about what actually might happen after the event, mm-hmm. that we might need
yeah.
to do. Three, the sort of sudden vanishing act done by people involved in said referendum and campaigning the moment the result came out. Four, the complete inability of both sides of this to decide to come to a mutually cooperative agreement, and I hold the EU very much responsible in that element. I commented before I went on holiday about how they're too obsessed with looking at the woods sometimes to care for the trees that are in it. Five, the Tory party's unbelievable focus on fighting with itself rather than actually managing to pull this thing off. Six, the Labour Party's decision to not engage in any way productively in trying to deal with the biggest problem facing this country in many years as we extracted ourselves from a 40-year like a free trade association and instead concern itself with trying to have an election, which it then got offered and turned down.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of that, you can add all of the things that have happened afterwards that we don't need to go into too much detail about. The daft strategy of negotiating, which appeared to basically not actually be a strategy of negotiating. Add on that the fact that it's been blindingly obvious for a year now, well, nearly a year now, that this backstop thing, where we're arguing, literally this whole thing has come about because we're arguing about the insurance policy. This is the dumbest thing ever, okay? But that this was not going to wash. And yet somehow, instead of doing something about that, we've just spent all this time arguing about it and the EU won't even budge. Like, how abundantly clear should it be to the EU that they might need to throw us a bone here? You know, otherwise this thing isn't going to get sorted. Presumably, they're also sitting there thinking, God, it'd be nice if this Brexit thing would finish, wouldn't it? You know, so why don't they throw us a bone here? But then all of the stuff that's happened since and the stuff that's been happening over the past couple of weeks is completely bonkers. You know, all of this stuff was stupid. We shouldn't have done it how we've done it. But we are where we are. And literally, our only negotiating chip is the fact that we might leave with no deal. And then our our own parliamentarians have decided to remove that negotiating chip. I mean, and I blame Boris Johnson for his stupid idea of suspending Parliament, because let's face it, whatever you're trying to do and whatever your strategy is, suspending your Parliament is never a good look. And so all he's done is exacerbate the problem. And then this whole thing of, like, no deal vote, calling an election, we won't give you an election until after this date and everything like that. It's just indicative of a whole chunk of people who are far more concerned with arguing amongst themselves and getting their own tribal point across than actually doing what is good for the country. And personally, I suspect that there's lots of other people who feel, of all political persuasions, who feel exactly the same about this. And I loved that footage of that guy in Morley yesterday taking Boris Johnson's arse and going, what are you doing here? You should be in Brussels sorting things out. And I think that he probably, like Brenda, who despaired of another election, yeah. I think that chap in Morley might have spoken for many people in the country, whatever political persuasion they are of. What are you lot doing, and why are you not sorting this out? And where's the bloody ideas about what to do about the backstop, which is what this whole argument's about in the first place?
Yep.
So among all that, I actually still believe that Boris Johnson could probably get us a deal and that we might possibly manage to leave the EU with a deal. So no, I will not be buying spaghetti.
Well, I was going to say, if you like chickpeas, I check the bottom of my cans in my, and they last at least until 2023. So chickpea party at mine.
Yeah. Also, I should add that whilst I say I'm not stockpiling, we do internet shopping. And I'm going to hold my hands up here and say that I don't do anywhere near enough of the internet shopping to help out. My wife does most of the internet shopping, and she appears to have decided that we might either be stockpiling coconut milk and soy sauce for the post-Brexit chaos and Mad Max world that we're going to live in, yeah. Or she's got a business idea that she hasn't told me about where she's going to set up a soy sauce and coconut milk shop.
And or she's like my mum, anything that's on offer, and then she just repeats the order. My mum's been stockpiling for Brexit since 1970 or whenever they first did online shopping. But anyway, we're going to move on from that, because Simon, I think you and the man from Morley are probably speaking for a lot of people. But we will stick with the political theme. Bear with us. It's not Brexit. It's the other big question at the moment. Are we going to get another general election? Poor old Brenda, as you mentioned there, Simon. Labour have been busy tabling some rather radical plans. Should they come to power? Among them is a version of, wait for it, a Margaret Thatcher policy from the 1980s. Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell wants to give tenants the legal right to buy their rented homes at a knockdown price. We've heard this before. How would it work, though? It's a little bit light on detail. Would landlords be compelled to sell? And if so, would they be forced to foot the bill for the discount? So, Sarah, tell us more. Right to buy.
Let's go back to the beginning. Right to buy was originally announced in the 1980s under Margaret Thatcher. It gave social housing tenants the right to purchase their council house at a discount. That discount was dependent on how long they'd lived in that council house, but it could be anything, I think up to 85% of the value of the property. So huge discounts for people who'd lived in council housing for a long, long time. And it was fundamentally one of her most successful policies ever, and it has shaped the housing market ever since, really. I mean, a lot of the reason that we're in the position that we are today, with not enough homes and house prices too high, is often put down to the supply of housing, and part of that is the sell-off of council housing in the 1980s from public sector to private hands. John McDonnell's idea is to extend that policy to the private rented sector. So rather than the government agreeing that social housing tenants can buy their property at a discount from the government, which then foots the bill, John McDonnell's proposal was that private tenants should be able to buy the homes that they rent from their landlords at a discount. You're right, it was very thin on detail. There was no explanation of whether or not landlords would pay for that discount, i.e. take a hit, and also how a discount would be set, you know, how big a discount that would be. I'm not sure legally it would work, because this is private property. You know, you can't force someone to sell you something that they own, at least not under our current laws, so they would have to change those. There are examples of it happening elsewhere. But it's not a policy that's gone down well, certainly, among landlords. Many of whom, let's not forget, are actually people who've been investing in buy-to-let as part of their pension plans. Because pensions haven't performed particularly well. Annuity rates are on the floor, thanks to low interest rates. And the state pension is not really sufficient to support people. People haven't necessarily, you know, we've seen DB pension schemes, final salary pension schemes closed over the years. And people quite sensibly have taken advantage of the opportunity to invest in buy-to-let in some instances in order to supplement that shortfall of income for their retirement. So to force those people to sell to tenants doesn't seem terribly fair, certainly not with no notice.
Well, the thing is, there's a lot of policy ideas and think tankery, which is not Cockney rhyming slammer, I promise you, around the Labour Party at the moment. And one of the leaders of this kind of thing is John McDonnell, who is an ideas man. And there's a lot to be said for the fact that he's an ideas man. He's also a dyed-in-the-wool socialist, which I'm not casting a slur upon him. He himself would tell you he is a dyed-in-the-wool socialist. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I think for many people, a lot of those policies look a bit like the appropriation of other people's property and assets. And whilst that plays pretty well with the people who don't have the property and the assets, it doesn't play so well with those that do. And so things like this, and things like taking 10% of companies' shareholdings and giving them to employees, which sounds good, but you have to remember that the company doesn't own those shareholdings. Other shareholders do, many of whom are individuals like us who might hold them through our pension fund or might hold them through funds or shares or things like that. You are taking something that belongs to someone else and then giving it to someone else. And you have to sort of, how are you going to, the renationalisation of the National Grid, the energy companies, the things like that, the water companies that's being talked about, that stuff does belong to other people. And are you going to reward them properly for what you're taking off them? Or, as Sarah said, are you going to try and take it off them at a discount? And who's going to pay for that discount? Are you going to pay for that discount? Mm. Or are they going to pay for that discount? And to put some political balance in here, you know, whilst I said that suspending your parliament is never a good look, appropriating other people's property is also never a good look. So I can understand the concerns about this. Right to buy in itself was not necessarily a bad idea. My grandmother, my mum's mum, moved into her council house brand new in 1966 from her other council house. Funnily enough, my mum was on holiday at the time. When she came back to her old home and knocked on the door, expecting it to be opened by her mum, a stranger opened the door. And my mum was like, "Who are you?" And she said, "Well, we moved in. You must be D, and your family's moved. You've got a new council house in the meantime." So my mum went off to where the new house was. But my nana, you know, moved into that house in 1966, and she bought that house in the mid-1980s. For what, like, in reflection now, seems like a very good price. But in the 1980s was just a discount to the market value. But it gave her home ownership in the area that she had lived in since she moved over from Ireland, you know, after the Second World War. And she contributed a huge amount to that area over that time. And she'd spent decades, you know, her and my grandfather had spent decades paying rent to the council kind of thing. So actually rewarding that kind of person with the opportunity to own their own home that they would never have otherwise been able to do by that point, you know, she was a widow and so on, was a good thing. The problem was they didn't build another house to make up for it. So we've had this massive decline in social housing. And part of the reason actually for promoting buy-to-let as an idea, buy-to-let was cooked up as an idea in the early 90s, was to try and replace that, to fill that gap, to provide some more rental homes for people. So it's more complicated than just a look at those rich, evil capitalist landlords over there, those rentiers taking all that money and we should be flogging it onto people. But I don't know. I mean, we've had this idea cooked up before in the sort of what we dubbed help to sell, where it's like landlords could sell to their tenants, but they'd get some kind of, they'd actually get a tax break. I think that's a better way of doing it. It might sound completely bonkers, but there's lots of landlords who probably would like to sell up, who would get very large capital gains tax bills otherwise. Why not give them the discount that the person gets on the property, just take that off the other person's capital gains tax bill if they've got one, and it evens itself out and the discount pays for itself. I don't know. I think that a lot of this stuff would get very heavily watered down, because there would be lots of problems with it that when you're indulging in your thought leadership and your think tankery, you don't necessarily go into the full details. And there was a very good point made after there was a big FT story this week about the cost to companies and shareholders of this taking their shareholdings and handing them to workers, but then also saying that it would lead to years and years of legal cases as, you know, overseas companies started arguing that this shouldn't, that the, legally this wasn't allowed to happen and so on. And you might just end up with just, you know, a bigger mess than you've already got.
There's a great phrase my dad always used, that there is no situation so bad that it can't get worse. So if you think that this is all a big old mess and it can't get worse, oh, it can.
And generally speaking, most situations like that that do get made worse by meddling. There should be a meddle test for ideas. Is this a big, bold idea that could really be a game changer? Or does it sound a bit like meddling?
So Sarah,
and if it sounds a bit like meddling, don't do it.
Sarah, this is exactly what I was going to ask you. And where have we meddled more, I think, politicians of all hues, than in the housing market? Does the housing market need any more kind of meddling to it? I mean, what could be the knock-on effect with more tinkering?
Well, the housing market's already in a slightly fragile state because, as you point out, politicians love to tinker with it. The buy-to-let market particularly has seen a lot of change over the past 4 years. And a lot of that is still playing out because housing takes a long time to turn over. You know, people take mortgages, they're 5-year terms. So there are people out there who still have not felt the actual impact of a lot of these changes. It will take time to filter through. It's changing the shape in terms of lending done today. Buy-to-let lending is nowhere near where it was pre-2015 and even lower than it was pre-2008. But that part of the market is already under a lot of pressure. So no more tinkering for them would be very much welcome, I think, to allow them to plan and adjust and just see how the changes that have already happened pan out. In terms of whether or not there is tinkering that could be done, I think that there is actually, that might be really helpful. So we talked at the beginning of this podcast all about savings rates being on the floor, and part of that, the excuse given by lenders and providers is that mortgage market is so intensely competitive that they can't price mortgages any higher than they are at the moment. As a result of there being lots of money in the mortgage market and not enough people wanting to borrow it, hence the competition, actually part of that is because the housing market's a bit broken and it's not turning over. So you've got good, healthy levels of first-time buyers getting into the market with the help of mainly Help to Buy, the government equity loan scheme, and a lot of that is new build. But there is this logjam further up the chain where families who are already on the ladder are facing this choice where they could move to a bigger home and free up that house for the first-time buyer. But in doing so, they'd have to pay stamp duty at such a high level that they think, well, why don't I just spend that money on extending my existing home? Because then at least I'm getting the benefit of that expense rather than the government getting the benefit of it. And as a result, that is stopping the whole market from moving. There's also the same problem at the top of the market, actually, with downsizers who are looking at moving and, again, facing such enormous stamp duty bills that they think, oh, I'll just stay put. And so transactions in the housing market have dropped dramatically and are now, I think, in the long run average, much lower than they have been over the past sort of 10, 15 years. If your objective was to get the housing market moving and kickstart economic growth, and the housing market is a really good place to do that because it's so valuable in terms of economic capital value, then if you were to change stamp duty, you might trigger some more people to want to move. And that would start to move the whole housing market on, and it would make a lot more opportunities for first-time buyers to get onto the ladder, as well as people who are in five-bedroom houses to move into smaller homes. You know, the whole thing would be better. There has been some mention of that, although we didn't see anything on it in the spending review this week from Sajid Javid. They suggested switching the tax from being paid by the buyer to being paid by the seller, which I think just passes the buck and doesn't actually achieve the objective, which is surely to get the housing market moving. But if they were to do something with stamp duty, I think that might actually have a positive effect on the housing market. What they would do in practice, I'm not sure.
And I would file that under unmeddling rather than meddling.
Exactly what I was thinking.
Because until Gordon Brown started meddling with stamp duty was a flat 1% on all properties above a certain level and was not a problem.
Exactly what I was thinking. All right, well, finally, we will move off politics. We're going to, well, I don't know if we can, because this is all about government plans to go carbon neutral. But it's got a lot of us talking about, look, how environmentally friendly are electric cars? How much better are they than petrol and diesel? At the moment, with the technology that we have, and when you factor in all the issues about carbon footprints needed to produce the batteries, you've got an answer, Simon, for me, haven't you?
Yes, actually, we do have an answer. And this is a really good study, OK? Now, it's by Imperial College. So you go and can work on the basis that it's a proper study.
So really,
okay.
Mean to say, is it by VW or something?
No. Okay. It was done in partnership with Drax Electric Insights. One of the comments we often get on our articles, and one of the comments that people often make, is that, yes, it's all very well telling us about this electric car and how it's much better for the environment, but what about the cost of making it and the battery? Well, according to Imperial College, an electric car cannot be more polluting than a petrol or diesel equivalent over its lifetime. This takes into account making the car, building the battery, and then the expected emissions over a lifetime of that car. Interestingly, the lifetime of said car is actually not that long, 150,000 kilometres, which a lot of cars run for longer than that. But it claimed that pure electric plug-in models, on average, emit just one quarter of the carbon dioxide produced by conventional cars with a combustion engine. And even when you factor in the carbon footprint required to produce their batteries, electric models still emit half as much CO2 as a petrol or diesel engine car over the course of their life cycle. So basically, they will, over the course of a lifetime, half as much CO2. And it also predicts that those figures should get better in the years to come, as A, companies get better at producing batteries, and so that becomes less carbon intensive, but also B, as the electricity that we use shifts more towards renewable energy, which is happening, and that should then drag that down. So it's 15-year lifetime, 10,000 kilometres a year on average. But it did add in a caveat that said that not all electric cars are the same. This should be obvious, but if you were to buy a smaller electric car with a smaller range, then the carbon cost of creating that car and that battery is considerably lower than if you buy one of the big luxury motors that tend to have the longest ranges, i.e. your Teslas or your Jaguar I-Paces and so on. And that actually people obsess about range, but it's the creating those big batteries that deliver that big range is more carbon intensive. But even those cars are greener than a petrol or diesel equivalent. Now, there is one caveat here.
Another one?
Okay. Yeah, there is one caveat, and this is a personal caveat. This is not a caveat that comes from Imperial College.
Right.
And this is something that I'd like to see some research done into to try and put a figure on it, which is the fact that obviously the greenest car that you can have is a car that has been around for a long time, because the environmental cost of creating and building that car has already been done, and that it's already been, you know, divided up over the years, amortized away, whereas going out and buying a new car involves the environmental cost of creating the car and then you're scrapping another car. So maybe we should just be, is it greener to buy a 10-year-old petrol or diesel car and run that for 15 years than to buy a new electric car and run that for 10 to 15 years? That's the question I want to know the answer to.
Thank you. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have an answer to Simon's question, or indeed you're a researcher and you've already looked into this, and you're sitting there rather smugly with the answer, Simon, how can they get in contact?
They can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can argue amongst yourselves or provide an informative insight if you so choose to stand out from the crowd in the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.